Hi, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and this is Future Proof. So actually, today we have Reshma Sohoni, the co-founder and managing partner at Seedcamp, a seed fund in Europe. They are actually really impressive because they hunt for new companies to invest in seed stage and pre-stage. Check sizes of 100K to 500K, rounds of up to 2 million. Europe stole her away from the US, which you'll hear about. And it was really fascinating to talk to her about talent pools, how to look for leading indicators, figuring out which sectors are going to grow in the future, macroeconomic factors throwing off your predictions as an investor, and the benefits of going to conferences and talking to other people as an investor. And that came up because I spoke to her at Web Summit, where about 75,000 people are in the background, so you'll have to forgive the audio quality here. And I just wanted to, as an aside, thank you all for the notes about when are we coming back, because this is our first episode in a while. And the answer is you've got a block of at least six straight episodes coming to you weekly. So be sure to subscribe if you haven't heard us yet. And without further ado, here's our conversation.
Great to be with you here. My name is Reshma Sohoni. I'm co-founder and managing partner at Seedcamp. We are a seed fund in Europe, and that's what we do, is we hunt for sort of new companies to invest in pre-seed and seed stage. Check sizes of 100K to 500K, rounds of up to $2 million. And Europe is our playground.
And I was going to say, I mean, I think that one of the things that I came to realize as I was looking up your background is that you have an interesting story in terms of how you kind of almost fell in love with Europe and how Europe stole you away instead of making billions for a number of different startups on my side of the pond, right?
Yeah.
So can you tell people a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think probably one thread throughout my life story is the kind of the underdog, and I think always being the immigrant as such. So I was born in India, lived there 10 years, and so we were immigrants into the U.S. for education and kind of the opportunities that unlocks, and had an incredible, you know, undergrad experience at UPenn and the East Coast, worked in the East Coast after, but the dot-com crisis happened, and, you know, I did well and loved it during the boom years, obviously, and the crisis happened in 2001 or so, and I think, I was figuring out what next, and one of the opportunities that came up was to study for an MBA in Europe with a one-year degree, because I'd actually done my undergrad at Wharton, and I thought, all right, I can't do 2 years of this nonsense.
Yeah.
And so you came for that opportunity. So I was an immigrant yet again in Europe. And, I mean, that experience unlocked a whole continent for me, in that I went from literally knowing zero people, you know, to having sort of 400 new best friends and all of those folks doing such interesting things across the footprint. But I think in that time I noticed so much kind of latent talent, and that was certainly not rising above the noise enough in terms of competing with the American voice. And I think the true kind of underdog, you know, immigrant spirit in me decided, well, I can help here and I can make a difference and bring hopefully some value, capital, you know, insight here. And so I did. I fell in love and with the whole space and opportunity. And then here I am 14 years later, and it's been a great ride.
Love it. So now I wanted to ask you, and this is obviously something that I'm sure a lot of people are thinking about a lot now. I think one thing that's interesting to me is that generally you have a lot of innovation happen with technology companies and with startups in general. I mean, do you have any thoughts in terms of how the U.S. is welcoming people from different cultures into, I can't help but wonder that the whole debate that they're having now over there might not mean necessarily good things even 20 years down the line in terms of innovation, because if you don't get the new blood into your infrastructure, then maybe the next Facebook or Amazon doesn't get created on your shores. Maybe it winds up in France or Belgium or Portugal.
I think absolutely right. And look, I think there's a lot to unpack there. The biggest element of what you're talking about is timelines, right? Because innovation and us, we work on 10, 20-year timelines. So everything we sow the seeds of now, you know, you're not impacted. And I mean, you're impacted, of course, with day-to-day and what happens at shorter time frames. But really, the fruits of all of that and the big trees that grow out of that, to use an analogy, are 10, 20 years down the line. That's how it takes long. It takes, you know, huge shifts to happen. But all the policies and regulations do matter now, because that's the talent coming in or out. And, you know, the U.S. has been incredible with its university infrastructure across all of the U.S. and the marketing capabilities of our universities to attract incredible engineers, incredible marketers, you name it, skill set, theater, whatever it is, and, you know, journalism to attract talent there. But if you can't provide visas and opportunities for work past that point, there is a brain drain back, right? And those folks are absolutely getting welcomed back into, you know, being an Indian immigrant, back into India, back into China now for a while as well. But absolutely, I'm seeing it happen back into France with their very open policies towards highly skilled talent. Germany, UK has been copying the book from the US for a decade now, and we've had some incredible kind of entrepreneur visa and things. So you do get the formation of companies like a DeepMind that, you know, are deeply ingrained into AI, and Google bought them for $400 million unknown a few years ago. And they're literally, you know, the most advanced sort of AI business in the world. And they decided not to move after the acquisition to the Valley. They actually rejected that, and that was part of the offer, as to say, we want to build a center of excellence in London. So, you know, you get enough sort of density of those kinds of talent pools happening in Europe, and that's where the next 10 to 20 year companies are going to come from.
So when you started, so SeedCamp was what, 2007?
Yeah, 11 years old now.
Wow, congrats. I mean, so when you started down that path, did you imagine that those talent pools were going to be as important to your ability to succeed, or for Europe's ability to succeed? Like, what did you learn along the way that you did not know in 2007 that you know now about how these talent pools, grow and thrive?
Yeah, I think, I guess fortunately when I started 11 years ago, I'm fairly old, so I've had, you know, a few experiences to go through different sort of roller coasters and also understand key aspects about building multi-thousand people organizations. And so, talent's so central to that. So I think we had hoped for that, and we had hoped that if you bring the right networks and expertise on communication and that kind of knowledge building, these pools will aggregate and become each other's CXO levels and great operators and executors. So I think we did hope for that, and that has come to fruition. And it's also, again, being helped by the European, Indian, other immigrants who went to the U.S. in the 70s, 80s, and 90s and are feeling that pull back to Europe. For whatever reasons, families, politics, etc., and they're American essentially, and they're coming back here, right? With an incredible set of experiences, having worked for five generations of digital companies, and, you know, Microsoft, then Yahoo, then Google, then Facebook, and LinkedIn, and so on and so forth. So it's a combination of these two talent bases with a core of, you know, that pull to a set of regulatory infrastructure, policies, etc., that are so meaningful to people like you see here today, which is mobility and openness and you know, welcoming that kind of innovation.
I love that. So we always do a brief lightning round of a totally irreverent off-topic question. So it's like a minute. Are you ready for it?
Sure.
Okay. Most exciting thing you've done over the last year. I think you alluded to one of those things before we started recording.
Yes, I had a baby 6 months ago, so, and without any painkillers this time.
But how do you not look tired? Which is like, I look tired and I did not have the baby. I have two kids at home, but like, I feel like they were just born, even though they're 5 and 2.
I know, so, right?
That's funny.
No, I've been, the other exciting thing, I think getting into nutrition and fitness, like, I guess I got, you get kicked in the butt after a baby going, oh my gosh, this is what I look like, and after two kids, and all right, I need to, so I just started right from get-go without kind of getting any excuses on board and just gone for...
That's funny. Actually, speaking of nutrition, out of the plate of things in front of us, what is your favorite and why?
The pastel de nata. I've had one. I waited as long as I could.
Is that the custard or the orange thing?
The custard.
Okay,
It's the dish of Portugal.
Yeah.
So
2 years ago,
must...
I walked 40 minutes to find like the place
one
that had the best reviews ever. Yeah.
So, partly it's resisting all of that until I just couldn't take it anymore, and I've had one so far, so I'm pretty pretty
what
proud.
You guys can't see, it's about like 8 inches away from us, so it's impressive that you've had that, you know, will. So, okay, two more questions. Thing that you like the most about business travel?
I think serendipity. I love that, you know, especially I think when you just have had too much, you don't want to probably meet another soul, but then you meet one of the best people you could ever meet. And so
I feel the same way about you. Thank you. Yeah. I understand because it's you plan as much as you can, and then something goes wrong or right. And you just roll with it, and it can be for the best. Totally. What's one thing about you that nobody who knows you professionally would ever guess?
Gosh, that's a hard one. I'm kind of an open book. I get told that I say a lot of things people are thinking, but won't say for themselves. So it's probably hard not to know, you know, what I truly am like. But
that's fair.
I will say, one thing I'll say is I sadly subscribe to the only paranoid survive, and so I do feel like I'm paranoid about a lot of things all the time. So I don't think that comes across to the startups I meet or the VCs that, you know, I'm working with. And yeah, there you go, a little secret.
Yeah, no, that's actually pretty cool. And you know, actually, that's a pretty good transition out of this part. I think one of the things that's interesting to me is you have a lot of startups that are maybe not paranoid enough, or they don't beat up their own stuff enough. I mean, how important is it for you when you're meeting with startups, when you're hearing ideas, to be able to relay that type of criticism? Because I imagine if you're trying to create the future in some way, shape, or form, you've got to make sure that you've got to be hard on people.
Absolutely. Actually, I think hopefully the things, as I've gotten older, I'm a bit prouder of, is I think I've always given very straight feedback. But I think my delivery has improved greatly. I think it was probably a bit too tough at the beginning, and I've gotten called names for that. And I think hopefully, and now I've learned how to deliver that for acceptance, because it's no good if you feel like, great, I'm being honest, but the person taking it needs to be open to taking it. And there's a way, you know, there's a way to create that vulnerability and openness to taking it. And so the other day, I mean, we were meeting some founders, and the dynamic was so off. And so we just sort of said to them, look, you know, we really want to help you, and hopefully we'll invest. Even if we don't, what we don't want you to walk out here is not knowing what we really think about what's, you know. And we said, what do you think of your dynamic? And here's what we think. And so that kind of, you know, that laying it up like that is
that allowed them to be receptive
to
it. Oh, that's smart. Yeah, because I think one thing that's interesting to me is I meet also a lot of founders where they have a interesting idea, but there's something about it could be their dynamic or just in terms of the way that they approach business, where maybe they've got the best idea out of anybody you'll meet with this month, but they're not fated to succeed. But there might be somebody else with not as world-changing of an idea, but they're going to have seamless execution. I mean, and you just have to watch for that, right?
And I think the biggest, probably my biggest advice is, and I think we've gotten better at seeing through who does this and doesn't, is look yourself in the mirror before you're pitching, and really ask yourself the worst questions or the hardest questions you can ask about you, your team, your idea, your technology, your execution. And those are the questions that are running through people's minds as you're pitching for money or even trying to recruit talent. And if you can honestly answer them, you won't have answers to them, but it's how you've thought about them, that you know that there are problems to be solved, that is an incredible dialogue you can have, and you are likely to get that investment, because nobody does have the final answer.
Right.
But we've really tried to push and see the founders we back them, because they can sort of, you know, that 800-pound gorilla in the room, and can kind of address that and not just put it in the corner and never try to deal with it.
Right, yeah, because, I mean, ultimately, somebody's going to be noticing that gorilla. It's pretty big, so why not actually confront it head-on? Makes sense. How about flipping the script a little bit to talking more about you and your approach? Because what I'm interested in is you've had a number of different really sharp companies that have made something of themselves that you've gotten involved in at a relatively early stage, and How do you predict winners? Like, how do you forecast the future in terms of what technologies are going to be big, in terms of what startups are going to make it? And obviously, I don't know if you know offhand officially what your batting average is,
yeah.
Because nobody really necessarily truly knows, and you just hope that the best things that you do outweigh all of the things that don't work out. But,
yeah.
I mean, what's your methodology for anticipating what will work in the market and what won't?
Yeah. I mean, I think I fundamentally believe us as even the first check-in are still reactive in the sense that we do look at what's being researched and worked on at the university level. So those are the real leaders, right? That's the 10 years, 20 years of machine learning research and building neural networks. And that, I mean, that's what's happening. So we're always following that is what's coming out of the MITs and the UCLs and the Oxford, Cambridge, those clusters and you know, what are people gravitating towards? That's our leading indicator. And then the commercialization of that is always going to follow, obviously, is the laggard. And so then we look at who are the founders and the talent that's trying to bring those opportunities into the market, right? And often I have this analogy with the Israeli Defense Forces as well. It's like I think it's called the 82,000 unit. Like, there's a lot of cutting edge sort of defense technology and things that are being worked on there. And then a bunch of those guys who then exit out will become entrepreneurs,
yeah.
And take that technology into the consumer, you know, B2B framework. And so it's similar, right? Because that's where the research, the kind of cutting edge development is happening. So I think to some extent, in a way, job is easier, not easy, because we're still at the bleeding edge of this stuff in fintech and suretech and so forth. But those are our guideposts, and they kind of give us a little bit of a nose to where to follow. That said, you know, at the early stages, I will say it's a numbers game. Like, I don't understand any early stage investor who can pretend that they're not lucky, right? We are lucky. I mean, I think we let our statistics play our way, and also I hope we do become better at our jobs and recognizing certain patterns and breaking those patterns as well as needed. But there's a lot of luck and there's a lot of numbers.
Yeah, and I also think that there's a lot of, we all to some extent, whether or not you're a startup advisor or investor, if I were to ask you off the top of your head, not to put you on the spot, how is proactivity from a founder correlated with success versus having a co-founder correlated with success versus all these other things? It's like, we don't have the data directly. Like, anecdotally, we know this because you've spoken to 400 people in the last two days, probably.
Right.
But in terms of having a spreadsheet and being able to look at all these different columns,
yeah.
And being able to say, well, these are the things. I mean,
we've done that, actually, because we have 300 companies. And so we've, you know, we've come out with four or five indicators of, if they score highly on this, we should back them. But there's absolutely always who look good on paper, and we're still like, something's telling us this is not the one to back. Or, I know it doesn't score this kind of score on here, but there's something about it that, you know, we should back these folks, right? That's...
Because it's interesting, and obviously, you know, since we're recording this the day of the U.S. election, I'm thinking about, you know, Nate Silver, you know, the statistician.
Yes, yes, yes.
538. And, you know, one thing that's interesting is how they essentially beat up their model, and they always look to see how can they improve that?
Right.
How can they improve their predictions on an ongoing basis so that their forecast year after year wind up being more and more reliable?
Yeah.
And I mean, I'm wondering, do you have any type of process for looking to see, okay, it's the end of 2018, how did we do in looking and, you know, taking these meetings and analyzing companies versus last year versus the year before?
Absolutely.
Is there a formal process?
Absolutely. And you're as good or bad at doing that as good and bad both your toolkit is and also your data entry is. Because every job at the end of the day is data entry. It's the people I meet. Am I inputting them back in? Is the contact, you know, is your CRM? That's why CRM, like, is an ever-going challenge for everybody and sucks for everyone, right? So we do that annually. I just came back from maternity leave, and so we as a team sat down in my absence. What did we do right? What did we do wrong? What can we tweak? And we do a weekly one as well, but that's obviously more tactical. And we absolutely, every year we sit, or every 6 months we sit down and say, what's working? Because, you know, the pace of our deal flow is, we do a new deal about every 10 days. I mean, that's unusual, and few organizations in the world sort of do that. But because of that pace, we also need to have a process by which we're actually analyzing and seeing if we're true to strategy, where we're deviating, what's, you know, again, what's going right or wrong.
The nice thing is that it essentially makes you sit on more data if you structure it right.
You
actually gave me an idea for a startup that you can look for and back. I'll tell you after we stop recording, but you get all the credit. I think that in a lot of ways this data capture is a very major issue for people, because one thing that's interesting to me is if you see pundits on, you know, TV, they tend to make predictions about this is going to be big and whatever, and they just try to say something that's the more outlandish or the more interesting, because they're incentivized to say something interesting as opposed to something that's accurate, right? So I'm wondering, do you think that the investment community, generally speaking, is looking up to the leaders that have the best track record, or is it just, you know, following people who are the most dynamic or just trying to get on television the most?
In terms of who we follow as thought leaders, or in terms of investing?
Just in terms of who you guys follow in general. Because my concern is that maybe there's some people who are almost, they're in the media for the wrong reasons because of their dynamicism and not because of their accuracy.
It's a great question. What a loaded question, right? It almost gets into like fake news. It's not fake news, but everyone's biased and everyone's bringing something to the table as they're speaking. So I think we, you know, our job is always to kind of get signal from noise. And so I think we're pretty decent in terms of whatever gets said on these stages, or even what I was saying on the stage today, and you know, cutting out a bunch of the noise and figuring out what's the real signal from it. And, you know, actually a little tidbit for all of those listeners out there. I mean, us as VCs are obviously huge marketers of our own companies as well. And so you'll hear certain companies being mentioned that they've never said before, or, you know, partly this goes into your question, or that they stand out. But we're often marketing those. It's an imminent moment for them fundraising or launching, or, you know, something's happening. And then so we're mentioning them on stage, right? So there's always a reason for why it's being mentioned. So I think you have to look behind all of that. Doesn't mean it's a bad thing that someone's pushing something or not, but it's to understand what are all the extenuating factors around what's that's a long-winded answer.
I think that's really interesting, because that got me thinking about something that another founder said to me like a year ago, which got me thinking, which is that, you know, I've met with all these VCs and nobody ever really actually explains to me why money or funding isn't funding, meaning they kind of talk past the point that it actually does matter who you select as your investors, assuming you're lucky enough to be in that situation, which this founder was. So to me, it's an interesting question, even to you. I mean, forget about the fact about necessarily marketing, of course, what you do, but just objectively, if a founder is selecting between funding sources, what's the difference?
It matters. We've seen a huge correlation. I'm always, you know, conscious causation or correlation, but a huge correlation between tier one investors around your table and success versus tier two, three investors. And again, because correlation, there will always be exceptions where somebody early stages was invested by someone tier two or three, and they rose up, and the numbers did what they did, growth did what it did, no matter who was going to be around that table, right? And so you'll have those. And that's why some of the brands that we hear so much about are backing their 10th unicorn, their 20th unicorn, and, you know, you got the Sequoia and Benchmark, who become household names, oddly enough, because, yeah, that correlation's been there. And I don't want to give too much credit along causation lines, but I think the correlation comes from a lot of things, like network effects, and they become ever powerful today than they were 20 years ago. So our companies, 300 of them, are on a platform called Mobilize, and they're constantly asking each other questions on there. And their speed to answers and speed to quality answers, right? Because these are answers implemented by their cohort, by their peers.
Yeah.
I mean, it would take someone not in that network 3 months to figure the answer out to some of these things, and they can figure that out in a week. That's a huge advantage.
Yeah, and then, it's just an ability. But I think you raise an important point. I mean, ultimately, there are these human connections where if you get invested by the right person and they have, like, another investment that's a year or two ahead of yours that you can learn from, or if there's the opportunity to build some type of partnership, you are creating the future at a faster rate than you would otherwise.
Yeah. And, I mean, on your thing about, like, pundits up there, you know, I'm very worried about the next crisis. Because, like, there's a lot of people going up on TV or on stage saying, it's happening, and I'm like, stop saying that! Like, just, you're self-fulfilling. It all becomes, like, a self-fulfilling prophecy, so...
It's interesting. I think that there are a lot of people who kind of almost bet that, okay, if they say the sky is falling, and it doesn't fall, nobody's going to call them out on that. But if it does fall, then they're going to look like a genius. So it's like this kind of calculation on a lot of people's part. And if you, I always say this with this, you know, with American baseball, with the batting averages, if you put pundits on TV and you had their name and their title and what's their batting average, what percentage of the time have they said something that wound up being true?
Yeah.
You know, like, I don't know if you want to do that also to political leaders, because you might have some that would have very low batting averages. But in general, it's like, why don't we break it down to the, because you do break companies down at that level where you look to see and say, they've missed their earnings
for
7 quarters in a row. You would put that down as salient information.
Yeah.
So, I mean, how do you, I think, if you're one of those people or if you're in your position actually, and I know this kind of dovetails into what we were talking about before, how do you get better as a individual investor or pundit in some way from 1 year to the next year? You know, how do you kind of like do some reflection about where you're right, where you're wrong, how you can be less wrong next year? Because like you said, you are going to be wrong relatively often.
Yeah. I mean, I think what helps in our business is it's never transactional. It really isn't. Is you're going to probably, well, first of all, you work with the entrepreneurs for a long time, whoever you back, but whoever co-investors are as well, or these pundits are, it's not generally not transactional. You're going to be on boards with them. You're going to do co-investments with them. You might sell some of your portfolio to them. So it is a long-term relationship. So I think to some extent, we have that going for us, is that we can't, back to the point on look at yourself in the mirror, ask the hard questions, is you can't BS too often. So whether even for me, like sometimes I get VCs down the road saying, you haven't introduced me to anyone in a while of your companies. And I'm like, I can't show you bad things because not there, you know, I want to show you them at the right time. And if I just show you stuff because I want to have some throughput, you're not going to have a good impression of us longer term. So I think that helps. Now, that doesn't translate if those same people are necessarily going on different platforms and those are more transactional. But in our world, it's very long-term relationships, and you can screw me once, but like, I will not let you do that again. I will find better options basically out there. So that's how we keep things pretty honest. And
well, it's also interesting to me because as you talk about the fact that you're trying to make these long-term plays, and for me, what I've always noticed is the longer you're trying to predict out, the harder it is to be accurate.
Yeah,
because so many, I mean, every day is another opportunity for another black swan event.
Right,
And the further out you go, the more things will derail your vision of where things will be. So, I mean, do you have, like, a certain almost default number of years in your head that you feel confident in saying, oh, yeah, I think I know what 2025 will look like, but I can't say what 2030 will look like? Or does it really depend on the sector that you're trying to predict or invest in?
Yeah, that's a great question. No, I mean, I think because our fund lives are usually 10-year funds, we invest the first 2-3 years. I think usually around the ends of those cycles, we have a pretty good sense, and we've been pretty good at predicting those things for things we have control over. I think that's the other thing we can't discount, is how much those external factors matter. And you'll have some great vintages of your portfolios when you come in and when you've invested, but macroeconomic factors can just throw things, you know, completely off track.
But
again,
you know,
politics can throw things off track, right?
That's so true. No, I was just going to say about what that's a somebody told me recently, and I thought this was a really good point, is to not worry so much about those crazy things that nobody can predict, because that's going to screw up everybody else's model,
right,
too.
Right. So, yeah, no. So, and I think in terms of how, you know, where, what should financial services and consumption of our these products look like in 10, 20 years, we have a pretty good idea of that, right? We have a pretty good idea of where machine learning is today and again, the best we can possibly do, but where that's going to go within commercialization with our companies over the next 10 years. So I'd say we have a pretty good sense within our portfolio. We're always trying to, again, get better at it, annually. Beyond that, I don't think we try to do too much, get into too much punditry, beyond that.
Yeah, yeah. No, apart from, you know, situations like this where you can actually, you know, since we're like towards the end of our time, I wanted to ask you, this reminds me, what's the benefit for you to get out there and speak to other people and to be at conferences like this? Because I can see it kind of go both ways, which is that you're making other people smarter and then they can compete against you. But at the same time, you know, the opposite can be true, where you're, you know, sucking some great information out of other people's brains that you can use against them. So it's an interesting thing that we all go to these conferences.
I know.
And then get things that then we...
Yeah. But that said, I think the for me versus you against is mostly not happening. I think it is the, you know, if you hear the same question asked by entrepreneurs in a row on, or same pitches, like if I hear 10, you know, machine learning ideas on in fintech, then I'm, or take food tech, right? Then you're like, all right, something's happening here, right? So I think it feeds my, you know, me as well, my knowledge base as well. I think it keeps you close to the hustle. Because I think the one thing, you know, again, with these, like the Midas list that was announced and other things like that, is you're getting judged on something you put money into 5 years ago, 10 years ago, and you're not that same person that decided on those things, you know, and you try to, you actually, I think you're a good investor if you try to keep as close to that moment back in the day when you did those, all those great, great investments. I think that's part of it coming out here every year is to be in it and just listen, you know, keep an open mind, listen. The other thing is, like, I've helped a bunch of VC funds in Europe start up as well, and been, you know, in an advisor capacity or whatnot. So yeah, I've given a lot of knowledge away, and people have literally like copycatted our tech tools we use, implemented those systems as well. But through that, they share deal flow with us as well. So I mean, I think it all kind of comes.
And ultimately, I mean, I kind of look at it and say, you're segmenting the market off of price, so there are certain people who can afford, quote unquote, to work with you at one level.
Yeah.
But for other people, the only way they can work with you is to hear you speak, to be inspired by what you're saying, then to do something, and then that's the impact you're having on the world. And that alone will not pay the bills, but at the very least, you can get some sense of self and you know, satisfaction from that.
Absolutely. I mean, and impact just matters more and more. I think the more and more you spend in any job or role or industry, you care so much more about impact, you know, after a while, more and more. So I think, yeah, that's a big part of it. And the other thing, again, I find, you know, entrepreneurs who have the choice of capital, the choice of talent to hire, the choice of customers to go after, they are so thoughtful about why they choose certain things. And we've been lucky, people come up to us and say, I heard you speak at X or Y or a women in tech event or whatever it is, and I'm really glad you did that, and I want to take money from you. And so, you know, it had maybe not even anything to do with the content actually, but just sort of being in those places.
Yeah, you, it's like dropping a whole lot of seeds, to paraphrase a name. And you don't know which ones are going to bloom and which ones aren't. But if you plant enough of them, some good things will come back to you.
Perfect. Seek out. Yeah.
And that's, I feel like, a great spot to end on. So, Reshma, thank you so much. This was really fantastic.
Great. Thanks so much.
And thank you all again for joining us semi-remotely after the fact at Web Summit. Hope you enjoyed this. And just remember to subscribe if you haven't already. We have a number of really great conversations coming up in the weeks ahead, so I'm really excited about that. And be sure to rate and review us if you haven't already. All of the shares that you guys are doing has helped us grow week after week, and we thank you so much for that. And until next time, this is Jeremy Goldman, and you've been listening to Future Proof.